The following is a presentation of ARSC, the Association for Recorded Sound Collections.
At this time, I'd like to introduce to you our next speaker, Mr. Jack Raymond. He is a public relations writer for a public utility in Washington, D.C., and as a collector of musical, film, and pop music recordings, he has been a major asset to a number of people, especially the people at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington. Those of you familiar with their musical theater reissues have already heard quite a number of items from Jack Raymond's collection. He's also the author of a new book called Show Music on Record from the 1890s to the 1980s. And he's going to talk to us today about both the book and the music of that period, theater music of that period, and Mr. Jack Raymond.
Thank you, Peter. This morning, Steve Smolian referred to Helen Roach as the person I unfortunately am not. Well, Milford Fargo is the person that I unfortunately am not. I'm sure you're all disappointed, as I am, that he can't be with us this year. But nevertheless, I consider it a really great honor to be asked to pitch hit for him. Suppose I were to tell you that I have on tape over here a most surprising documentary record, the voice of none other than George Washington. And after that, I shall follow it up with Abraham Lincoln and then Theodore Roosevelt. Well, the point I'm trying to make is that we can't go to the phonograph and play Washington or Lincoln, but we can play people from the 1890s on. In an historical context, I think this is a fact that is blurred to our eyes often, that we are living so close on the heels of this revolutionary invention. We can almost go to the phonograph and play, for example, Bach playing his organ of the chamber music of Haydn, the chamber orchestra of Haydn. In a historical perspective, it's very close. In the year 3000, people will be able to listen to speeches by Franklin Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, but not to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. They'll be able to hear Cole Porter singing his own songs, but not Stephen Foster. In the cultural history of mankind, there are certain crucial dates of technological advance, such as the invention of the printing press. The invention of sound recording is one such date. Mark it well, December 1877. It's so recent that I think we lose track of it at times, but it's a knife edge before which voices spoke, sang, and vanished, and after which we shall have a permanent record of at least some. Centuries from now, people will look upon the early phonograph records as we look upon the early cuneiform tablets, or incunabula in the field of printing. The sounds of the 1890s will forever remain the earliest sounds anyone can hear. Well, I didn't come here prepared to read a paper, and what I've been reading is a couple of paragraphs from the introduction to this book that Peter Bergman mentioned, Show Music and Record from the 1890s to the 1980s. The book is a reference book. It has about 4,000 listings of music from Broadway shows and musical films and television musicals, original cast, studio cast, composer recordings. And for example, Showboat alone has over 30 different listings. I hope you'll all go buy a copy. It's published by Frederick Unger, $11.95 paperback, $19.95 hardcover. I have order forms available, and that's all the promotion I'm going to do in the book. I was asked to talk, though, about how the book came to be, and the criteria that we used in including information and so forth. I certainly could talk for an hour on that, but I know that most of you in this room really, this is not your field. So instead of doing that, I am going to talk some during the hour about the genesis of the book. But I'm going to leaven that with some music. directly related to this field, the earliest original cast recordings from Broadway shows. Not the earliest, but some of the earliest, from the 1891 up until about 1920. I hope they will be a representative group of recordings so that those of you whose field is jazz or classical or other fields will get some sense of this great legacy that does exist in archives. And at the end, that will bring me to a serious point, the serious point that I'd like to make, that not enough is being done to preserve this music. And I'm not talking about storing the old 78s the right way. I'm talking about reproducing the 78s on LPs so as to make them more widely available and also of a more lasting nature, since they'd be in several collections rather than just a few. But let's start with a record, the earliest New York musical from which members of the original cast made recordings was Robin Hood, which opened presumably in Boston, though I haven't been able to track that date down. It played Chicago in 1890, then went to London, came back to New York in 1891, where it opened in September of that year. I might say that in the book, that is the opening date of a show, which is the key number for that show. So it's the New York opening of Robin Hood, which identifies that show numerically in the index and elsewhere. Two performers from that original production recorded numbers. Jesse Bartlett Davis recorded Oh Promise Me, which has just recently been put out on an LP. The other one, to my knowledge, has never been on LP. It's Eugene Cowles, who sang the Amorous song and recorded it in 1906, although he actually was in the 1891 production. Cowles had a fine bass voice, and the song is not a bad one. The lyrics are florid in the style that was popular in the 1890s. It tells of a blacksmith plying his peaceable trade, making swords for warriors, and it has lines such as, "Let hammer on anvil ring, let the forge fires brightly shine," and so forth. Oh, it's florid all right, but I think you will enjoy it. Yes.
I interject with the fact that it's probably well known that Cowles was a composer of songs, too. He wrote the song for Robin, which is recorded by Edith Wiggins and John Palmer and many others.
Thank you. He recorded one of his own songs, too, as a matter of fact, didn't he? Yes. You might well ask what my definition of show music is, so let me just say a word about that. It's music, as I say, from stage, film, television, even an occasional puppet show or something like that. But it must be a show which has played in America, in the United States at one time or another, even though it may have originated in some foreign country. So that's a pretty broad definition, actually, if you stop to think about it. For example, Tex Ritter is in the book. In 1931, he was in a show called Green Grow the Lilacs, and recorded and sang songs in the show, which he also recorded, Blood on the Saddle, the Chisholm Trail, and the title song from that show, Green Grow the Lilacs. Also, in 1952, he sang the theme song of that famous film, High Noon, under the titles, and of course that also is in the book. You find people like Louis Armstrong with 21 listings, ranging from Hot Chocolates in 1929 to The Day of the Locust, 1974, a span of 45 years. You find people like Edith Wilson, Ethel Waters, Helen Traubel, Paul Robeson, and Elvis Presley, as well as people who are perhaps more commonly associated with show music, like Fred Astaire, Al Jolson, Shirley Temple. In 1908, there was a show called The Soul Kiss, and it starred a comedian by the name of Ralph Hertz. This was his biggest hit. He was 30 years of age at the time. He played an unscrupulous lawyer in the show, and a number called Very Well Then establishes his character. And it's interesting in that he recorded not just the song, but also some of the introductory monologue leading up to it. It sounds very much like the intros to some of the numbers on original cast albums today. Hertz was born in Paris, but I would gather of English parentage, as he speaks with a decided English accent. Marvelous enunciation. You won't have any problem with the words in this one. The lyrics do have plays on words which were popular at the time, but perhaps have waned a bit. Things such as, if a man is sawing lumber, can you say, I see him saw? At any rate, let's hear it, at least for its historical value.
Anybody require a lawyer? If so, come to me. I carry my own line of private business. Alibi is always on tap. Testimony put in or taken out. Divorce it while you wait. This morning a lady, perfect lady, asked me if I could get her separated from her husband. I said I would. I said, on what grounds do you make your claim? Isn't he a good provider? Oh, yes, he said. He's a good provider. He's got 5 jobs in the last 2 weeks. Then said I was wrong. He won't buy me coffee for breakfast, he said. Very well, then I said, we'll get you a divorce on coffee grounds. Which we did. There are problems oft encountered which are puzzling to the law and require the erudition of a lawyer. If a man is sawing lumber, can you say, I see him saw? If he says no, can you say, well, I saw ya? If you give a ring to Nelly, who you love exceeding dear, could you truly say, yes, well, I ring my Nell then? And to hear a man at auction, must you have an auction ear? Must you have it? No.
Another French musical comedy star was Henri Leoni, who had a truly fine voice. He had been on the stage since the 1880s, and in 1906 in New York, he was in a show called The Parisian Model, from which he recorded the song, I Love You, Ma Cherie. It was his first record, and the only one he made in America, although he subsequently did record in London. I'd suggest that you forget the words to this one, but the melody line is lovely, and his voice is truly exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
In the history of musical shows, there is a woman who was truly a superstar of the early part of the century, Blanche Ring. She introduced in the good old summertime, Yip I Addy I Yay, I Want Rings in My Fingers, and so forth, which I'm sure many of you know. She had a strong voice that records well, and it's rather surprising that she didn't record more than she did. She had a stage career from 1902 to 1938, and she was also in films. In 1910, she was in a show called The Yankee Girl, and she recorded from that show, Top of the Morning. The lyrics talk about when you travel through Spain, they will give you a pain with their old Buenas Noches and such. And in France, bonjour and bon this and bon that. And in Germany, when anybody yells at you, wie geht's, but you can tell that as far as Blanche is concerned, make it a top of the morning. In planning the book, I was faced with a basic decision as to how to arrange the material, whether alphabetically by show or to put the shows in their historical context. I chose to do the latter on the grounds that it would be interesting to people using the book to see the shows in each show in its historical context. So in the case of My Fair Lady, for example, in 1956, you'll find alongside it The Most Happy Fella, Irma La Douce, film High Society. And under the My Fair Lady listings, you'll find the original production, the London production, the 1976 New York production, lots of studio cast recordings, and even five songs sung by Alan J. Lerner, the lyricist of the show. If you look under the year 1910, you'll find the show The Jolly Bachelors, which starred an Irish comedian named Nora Bayes. Actually, she was Jewish, not Irish, but that doesn't make her any less of a great Irish comedian. She was great, and she recorded a lot and had well-deserved acclaim. She was married to Jack Norworth, and Norworth was number two of her five husbands, and he was number two of her his three wives. Together, they were on the stage. They also collaborated in writing songs, such as Shine On, Harvest Moon. We're going to hear one of the songs from that show. Six in all were recorded, and of those six, only one has ever been reissued on LP. Has anybody here seen Kelly? Admittedly, a fine number, but it's been reissued three times, and none of the other five have ever been reissued. The one we're going to hear is Come Along My Mandy, written by Bayes and Norworth and sung by them.
Bells are ringing.
When I was a kid, like most of you, I'm sure, I started buying records. This is, however, back in the 30s. They were usually Deccas and Bluebirds because they were only 35 cents, whereas the Victors and Brunswicks were a lot more expensive. And I kept on buying up until the late 50s or early 60s, when suddenly I realized that I'd reached a point where I was buying things to fill in gaps and so forth, things that I just didn't give a damn about. And then I knew I was a collector. At any rate, along the line, I'm also an archivist at heart, I think. I began developing a card catalog of all the things I had, and then began adding cards of the things that I hoped to acquire someday. And it's that card catalog that became the book. When I did decide that I wanted to publish it, because there was nothing like that available on the market, I began going to the Library of Congress, since I live in Washington, and then to Rodgers and Hammerstein in New York, a few other institutions, and then began looking up private collectors. And I would endorse what some people were saying this morning, that I suppose in any very specialized field, if you really want to find things, you have to get out and find the collectors who have these, in some cases, extraordinary collections, as of course many of you do. So it was with the help of the institutions and also the collectors that the book was put together. Jerome Kern was one of the greatest composers of show music, of course. And we're going to hear now the earliest Kern song recorded by the person who introduced it in a show. The first original cast Kern song, you might say. Actually, the song was interpolated in a score by Leo Fall, a show called Der Liebe Augustin, which opened in Berlin in 1912, played in New York the next year, and had a very good run, then went on the road. But when it went on the road, the war was heating up, and they decided that instead of calling it Der Liebe Augustin, they change it to Miss Caprice, but it's the same show. The song is called Look in Her Eyes. It's not a well-known Kern song, but it is a beauty. And it's one of those shows that, one of those songs that really demonstrates, I think, Kern's genius. There's a verse and a chorus and a trio, and you come back to the chorus, and it just flows so inevitably and so beautifully and logically, and yet nothing at all hackneyed about it. It's sung by a guy who had a first-rate voice, as many of you know, I'm sure, George McFarlane, a very popular baritone of the time, who recorded a lot and was in the state. He was Canadian, as a matter of fact, but he played, I think he spent most of his professional career, I think, in this country. So let's hear Look in Her Eyes from Der Liebe Augustin or Miss Caprice.
Thank you.
Nat Wills was a comedian known as the Happy Tramp, well-known comedian of the Ziegfeld Follies and other shows. And there's a great number that he recorded, which has never been an LP, as of course none of these have ever been an LP, from the 1913 Follies, a song called New York, What's the Matter with You? We're going to hear that, and then right after that, a song by Chauncey Olcott, the Irish tenor to end all Irish tenors. He, besides singing on the stage, he also, as you probably know, wrote songs with Ernest Ball, including Mother McCree and My Wild Irish Rose, and the one that we're going to hear now called When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, which he introduced in a show called The Isle of Dreams in 1913. Olcott, to measure him by this recording, I, at least in my opinion, doesn't have such a hot voice, but it's interesting to see how he wanted to sing his song. But as I say, we're going to start off with the Nat Wills, New York, What's the Matter with You? It's a fast, lively number that deplores the way New York nightlife had slowed down. And it says that, for example, I've got to go home when the curfew rings and do the grizzly with my wife. Now, I assume the grizzly is the grizzly bear, which was a dance of the time. But it reminds me of that line in New Faces of 1952. Used to have a mistress and a yacht. Now I'm left with just a wife and an old canoe.
Please turn the cassette over at this point.
Well, de gustibus non disputandum est, and tastes do change over the years. And apropos that, I wonder if anybody here could tell me what musical show that played in New York in 1912 had 21 numbers from the show recorded by members of the original production. I'll bet you never even heard of the show, Bird of Paradise. Shows you how things change. It was a Hawaiian show, and there were 21 records, and they remained in the catalog up until the 1920s. Well, that shows how things do change. And it also shows, I think, the value of preserving everything, whether we happen to like it at the moment or not. Two dialect songs now, one by Joseph Cawthon, who began in minstrels in British music halls, later even went up into films. He made only two or three records, and it's a pity because I think his brand of humor has fared pretty well over the years. The song "You Can't Play Every Instrument in the Band" has been reissued, and it's a beauty. But the one we're going to play now is not. It's called "I Can Dance with Everybody But My Wife," from the show Sybil, 1916. In it, Cawthon says that his wife always wants to take charge when they're dancing. He says, "The trouble is that she insists on leading me, as she does in every other thing we do." "I can dance with everybody but my wife." And then we're going to start, though, with another song. This is Marguerite Farrell, an Irish comedian, singing "If I Knocked the L Out of Kelly" from Step This Way, 1916. It tells about Timothy Kelly, who owned a store and wanted his name painted over the door. So he hired Pat Clancy to come in to paint his name, and Clancy spelled Kelly with one L instead of two. So here they are. First of all, Margaret Farrell, "If I Knock the L Out of Kelly," followed by Cawthon, "I Can Dance with Everybody But My Wife."
Paper man came, tried to be back.
she's rotten. She says one of us is rotten, and I got a slight suspicion it ain't me. We kicked welcome off the mat. We nearly squashed our cats. What Sherman said of war now fits our plan. I can dance with everybody but my wife. I must admit, this makes me awful sore. I think we'd get along if she wasn't quite so strong, but she pushes me completely off the floor. With others, I'm as graceful as a young gazette, but with her, it's just a struggle and a strife. I can dance as good as Castle, but with her, it's just a rattle. I can dance with everybody but my wife.
Now we come to a true giant in the field of show music, Victor Herbert. The earliest original cast Victor Herbert song was a song from The Serenade, 1897, by Jesse Bartlett Davis and W.H. MacDonald, which was recorded by Berliner. Much of the early Victor Herbert material has been reissued on a Smithsonian set, which Alan Debus was largely instrumental in putting together, I think. An excellent collection. If you care about Herbert, you really ought to have that. We're going to hear a song from Eileen, 1917, The Irish Have a Great Day Tonight, sung by Scott Welsh, who sang it on the stage in the original Eileen production. A lot of people don't realize that this fine song had an original cast production, and that's so true of many. The Other Side also has Greek Evans singing Free Love in a Misty Moon? Free Trade in a Misty Moon. At any rate, let's listen to that. Good number.
Did you ever see an Irishman who didn't love a fight, or who wouldn't stay and see it to the end? Did you ever know of one who wore the very windy tight, or who wouldn't give his life to save a friend? And who can beat the Irish when it comes to making love? The other nations do the best they can, and in other ways they pick up, but sure they never lick up if they stand up and fight a man for man.
I'd love to hear sometime what a good sound engineer and a pack burner or some such equipment could do to that record. I would imagine there's a lot in there if you could drag it out. Several people have asked me about my experience in finding a publisher for the book. So for what it's worth, I'll touch on it very briefly. I made up a little presentation of the elements of the book and then began going around New York publishers, or publishers generally. Arlington House, Bowker, Oxford Crown, and Greenwood Press in particular. And I got polite interest, but not much more, really. And I think the problem was that this book is not a discography in the classical sense, in the Brian Russ sense. That was not the intent. And it wasn't really until I went to Frederick Unger, where somebody there said, well, you know, maybe we could do this in a somewhat different fashion with photographs inside and a fancy jacket and so forth, and find a wider market for the book. So that was all right with me. Anything they wanted to do, I just wanted to get the cards published in book form. I had nothing to do with the illustrations or any of the rest of it, but if it sells more copies, that's fine with me. In 1917, Irving Berlin wrote music for a show that was called Dance and Grow Thin, which I take to be aerobic dancing. The title song, Dance and Grow Thin, was sung by Van and Schenk and recorded by them. And we're going to hear that now. And after that, without stopping, we'll hear Francis White, who with William Rock were the famous team of Rock and White. I didn't know till I was checking in Rust's entertainment discography, making up these notes, realized that Rock and White together recorded a song, which was never released. Isn't it a shame to think that something like that could even be lying in a vault somewhere, maybe, or more likely not? At any rate, she made two records for Victor, and she was a comedian of the sort of like the baby snooks that Fanny Bryce introduced later, child humor. In this case, it's a child who learns how to spell a tough word, Mississippi. If I were to ask you what was the original, what was the first original cast album, I expect some people in the room would say Oklahoma. And maybe that's what I'd say too. Certainly a very good case can be made. But there was a show, The Cradle Will Rock, in 1937, Mark Lichtenstein's show, which was recorded by Musicraft on 12-inch discs. And the running time of that is nearly twice the length of the Oklahoma album, for example. If you go back before that, you have the two Brunswick albums put out in 32 or 3 of Blackbirds of 28 and Showboat. So I guess it doesn't matter too much to me. It's fun to talk about this kind of thing, but probably not very important in the long run. God knows in England they were recording Floridora, it was in 1900, in I think close to a dozen records of Floridora. I guess they didn't box it in an album, but it was the equivalent of a very long original cast album. Well, we're nearing the end, and I want to play three more performers. The first is Harry Fox, second-rate performer, frankly, who introduced I'm Always Chasing Rainbows on the stage in Oh Look in 1918. And I'm playing a chorus of that so that you can hear how it was introduced originally, and also to provide a foil for Al Jolson, who's going to follow up. Harry Fox had a very mannered style of delivery. As the song progresses, you'll hear his style get more and more mannered until he's finally singing things like, watching clouds going by high, high, and it's a bit much. At any rate, Al Jolson, who follows him up, is a real pro. And this is, to me, extraordinary, that here's the song. It's Rockabye Your Baby, which he introduced in Sinbad, 1918. This record, to my knowledge, has never been on an LP, even in a pirate version. I can't believe it. Now, his 1932 version has been reissued several times, and his 45 and 47 for Decca. But this original one, recorded at the time the show was in the boards, never been on LP. And it's a good, good performance, I think. So we'll start with the Harry Fox, I'm Always Chasing Rainbows, the music for which, incidentally, I'm told, was stolen from a Chopin impromptu. And then Al Jolson singing his great song, Rockabye Your Baby.
Baby kisses I'll deliver if you will only sing that.
And to wind up the illustrations, an Eddie Cantor song from the 1919 Follies. You don't need the wine to have a wonderful time. The reason I'm playing it is that the Emerson has been reissued, but this Pathé, which actually was recorded closer to the time the show opened, never has been. And also, you couldn't very well omit Eddie Cantor, I think, from this kind of review. It's a Prohibition song, and the message is, don't worry, fellas, liquor isn't the only thing that can turn you on, try girls.
Little Johnny Brown, never wear the frown when you say the country's going dry. Mamas tear their hair, but Johnny doesn't care. He's got everybody guessing why. When I said how quiet things will be, Johnny said, perhaps, but not for me. Cause you don't need the wine to have a wonderful time, while they still make those beautiful girls. Adam and Eve never tasted champagne, till they were able to go out and raise Cain. And any sweet miss who knows the right way to kiss can set any brain in a whirl. People like to drink because it makes them feel gay. A girlie on my lap can make me feel the same way. So you don't need the wine to have a wonderful time, while they still make those beautiful girls.
Well, I see by my watch I'm just about on schedule, leaving me just a few minutes that I wanted to save at the end to say the serious thing that I wanted to say here today. I hope you agree with me that music like that is really pretty damn good music, worth preserving, worth making more widely available. And there's a lot more where that came from. I did a quick check from the book, found that between 1891 and 1899, there were 22 New York original cast performances on records. Between 1900 and 1909, there were 46 more. Between 1909 and 1914, there were 82. That means that between 1891 and 1914, 150 original New York cast performances. Many of those, most of those, by a long shot, have never been reissued on LP. And I suggest to you, and I know that this audience contains executives of many large institutions, I suggest that something needs to be done to preserve this music and make it more widely available. And you may say, well, that's not my function, that's not my institution's function. Somewhere in this country, there should be a sense of responsibility for doing this. And I would just ask you to consider, even though it may be, in case of some institutions, unorthodox, why not? Couldn't we get involved in this? That's the reason I really was so happy to come here and talk, because I love this music. I think that this lore, this heritage, is something that really is worth preserving. It would seem to me, at the risk of getting overly specific, because there are always pitfalls you can't anticipate, that an initial seed money of something like $5,000 would be all that would be needed by an institution. The record companies, I think, as Smithsonian has demonstrated, are willing to be cooperative in this sort of venture. The records could be pressed in a limited run of 500, made available, if you want, only to educational institutions. Certainly, if staff time is a problem, there are collectors, myself and I'm sure many, many others, who would be happy to help with the programming, the tracking down of material, and so forth. It is not the kind of thing that would take time. And the kind of project that I'm talking about does not entail getting photographs, getting fancy albums, and so forth. It's a matter of getting it in a good first-rate transfer and then getting it duplicated and out. I think if you press 500 copies, sold them for $10 a piece, you would have an ongoing project, which over a period of months or years would be able to reissue an awful lot of this stuff. So again, I ask you, Library of Congress, Rogers, Hammerstein, Smithsonian, universities, can't something like this be done? Could it be done even in cooperation with some ARSC subcommittee or something like that? It just seems to me a pity that virtually the only thing coming out is being done, in most cases, very poorly by pirates, just to make a buck. Think back on the 16 songs, which I played here today because I did trim a bit. I think they're worth being available somewhere other than on the original 78s. I also suggest that the intangible rewards of any institution that might choose to do so would make it very, very much worthwhile. Thank you very much.